NATO member states agree on what they call a master plan to deter any potential Russian attack on multiple fronts. Saudi Arabia's warplanes bombed drug warehouses in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, leaving one person dead and three others injured. Iran receives for treatment the number of people injured in Friday's suicide bomb attack on a mosque in Afghanistan. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, NATO is preparing an anti-Russia strategy. The Secretary General of the Western Military Alliance says members are about to agree on an overarching plan for the defense of the Euro-Atlantic region.
We are in the midst of a transformation of NATO. Over the last years, we have stepped up and refocused on our collective defense to protect our own territory. And therefore, NATO ministers, NATO defense ministers, will today agree a new set of capability targets for all allies.
Jens Stoltenberg noted the plan ensures that the alliance has, quote, the right forces in the right place at the right time. He underlined that the relationship between NATO and Russia is at its lowest point. Meanwhile, defense ministers from some NATO members have been quoted as saying that the new master plan is aimed at defending against any potential Russian attack. The confidential strategy is reportedly for simultaneous attacks using nuclear weapons, hacking of computer networks, and assaults from space. The remarks reaffirm the alliance's core goal of deterring Russia. Moscow has, however, denied any aggressive intention, saying it is NATO that risks destabilizing Europe. And now joining us from Toronto is Aidan Jonah, Editor-in-Chief at the Canada Files. Hello, Jonah, Mr. Jonah, that is always a pleasure to check in with you. Now, Aidan, Russia has a point. NATO, through a lot of its actions over the last couple of decades, has made things the way they are now. Would they've reached the lowest point with Russia? Who's the provocateur here? Is it NATO or is it Moscow?
Oh, it's absolutely. It's absolutely no doubt that it's NATO. It has been always NATO in my view.
And your initial thoughts on how tensions got to this point where now there's actual military shuffling and redevising plans for possible nuclear conflict, for possible invasion, and basically things have gotten really out of hand. How do we get here?
For sure. I mean, I think it really starts back to obviously the fall of the Soviet Union itself. I mean, you look at Gorbachev and the leaders of the Soviet Union, when there's really full disillusion, there's promises from the West of non-aggression, of not expanding NATO. Instead, you had NATO continuing to expand. You had really Western attempts to balkanize Russia. And really just a basic lack of respect for the Russian nation as a sovereign entity. Whether you look at America's role in rigging the 1996 elections, simply put, to the present day, with the U.S. pulling out of treaties around nuclear weapons and such, it's simply put, at every single step of the way, almost every single step of the way, Russia has tried to act in good faith, and the West has simply acted in a really aggressive and borderline violent manner. So.
And Jens Stoltenberg, Aidan, says that this plan ensures that the alliance has, quote, the right forces in the right place at the right time. I'm sure if you ask Moscow, let's say you've had all your forces in multiple countries on our doorstep for quite a while. When was the right time or the wrong time? You've just increasingly been coming up to our front door, to our front porch in multiple countries and basically saturating as much of military hardware as you can there.
Oh, for sure. You've always had really these efforts to intimidate Russia, to go after China as well, of course. It's quite frankly, I mean, even Canada has its own role. Basically, there's at least more than 540 Canadian Armed Forces members in Latvia. And that was even starting in 2017. It's gone up since. So these countries around the world have really, yet again, to emphasize again, have really acted in an incredibly aggressive manner where, yes, they've always, it's not so much, I feel like this change that's occurring now anyways, I get the sense it's more of a confirmation of what they've been doing before, but there is this pretension of an attempted neutrality or some sort of middle ground that they were pretending could be reached, and I think now they're pulling the mask off, is where I would see things. It's simple as the fact that the West doesn't want peace. It, quite frankly, it does not want peace unless there is total subservience from the rest of the world to it, quite frankly. You have a weapons industry, billions of dollars worth to Western economies. The economies are built on the back of vicious war machines. I mean, you look at it even in the case of basically the UK, where they have vessels trying to venture into Russian waters in violation of international law. These countries, there's so many examples, they simply do not want peace. They can say every single nice little word they want, but it doesn't change their actions, because actions matter far more than talk.
All right, bud. Pleasure to check in with you. Thanks, and stay safe from Toronto, Canada. Aidan Jonah, Editor-in-Chief at The Canada Files. Meanwhile, Saudi warplanes have pounded the Yemeni capital Sana'a, killing at least one person and injuring three others. Yemeni media said the strikes targeted medicine storage units. A spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement condemned the bombing. Mohammed Abdul Salam also criticized as one-sided a recent UN Security Council statement that calls for de-escalation of violence in Yemen. He accused the world body of continuing its support for the Saudis, saying such statements embolden Riyadh to intensify its onslaught and siege against Yemen. The remarks came after the 15-member Security Council called for an end to the Yemeni army's battle for Ma'rib. That's the last stronghold of Saudi-backed forces. Army has made significant gains there over the past months. Our Sana'a correspondent, Abdulatif Al-Washali, says the international community remains silent on a Saudi bombing campaign against Yemeni civilians.
The Saudi regime 2 days ago has been begging the United Nations Security Council to stand with the kingdom against what they said the Houthis. But today they are killing Yemenis, they are killing citizens, and they are violating international law. And the Security Council has not yet done anything to condemn at least the Saudi attacks against civilians. The Saudi regime continues its violations against the international law, continues its killing Yemeni civilians. The international community did not anything until the moment. Mohammed Al-Salam, the spokesman for Ansarullah movement, condemned the attack. He said the statements of the Security Council goes biased toward the Saudi regime. The Saudi continues to use such statements to justify and to intensify its strikes on Yemeni lands.
Hospital in Tehran is offering medical treatment to some of the victims of a deadly terrorist attack which took place in neighboring Afghanistan just days ago. Iran's deputy ambassador has visited the injured at this facility. Official says following their defeat in Afghanistan, the U.S. and its allies are seeking to use Daesh to cause instability in the country. He says a recent increase in bomb attacks serves exactly that purpose. He believes regional countries need to redouble efforts to prevent similar acts of terrorism in the future. At least 60 people were killed and dozens injured in three back-to-back explosions which tore through a mosque in Kandahar during Friday prayers. Daesh has claimed responsibility. Iran and Russia have been very close, especially when it comes to cooperation in fighting terrorists in Syria, but the relationship has been taken to a higher level with a recent visit to Russia by Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri. During the visit, both sides agreed to boost defense ties further.
Chairman of the Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, has urged development of the country's defense ties with Russia. Bagheri, who made the remarks during a visit to Russia, said the ties between the two countries are deepening further and growing stronger in all areas. He pointed to his talks during the trip with his Russian counterpart and said that Tehran is determined to expand military cooperation with Russia in line with the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi's Look to the East policy. The top Iranian commander underlined that Iran and Russia will strengthen military cooperation. Heading a high-ranking military delegation, Baghdadi traveled to Moscow at the official invitation of the Minister of Defense of the Russian Federation, Sergei Shoigu. Russia and Iran discussed expanding cooperation in fighting international terrorism, which has been a top concern in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and the Caucasus region.
It's natural to counter the active threats of war that have been coming from America, not just during this administration, but during the previous presidential administration.
This may indicate that their military cooperation will be more pronounced when it comes to fighting extremists and terrorists in Syria. The sticking point here will be how the two will counter the repeated Israeli strikes on Syria. There are also other issues that could involve Iran and Russian military cooperation. PJAC terrorists in Iraq's Erbil region is a problem that Iran has addressed. Recently, Iran warned Iraq's Kurdistan regional governments against allowing terrorist groups to use its territory to pose threats against the Islamic Republic. The Caucasus region, which includes Azerbaijan, is another issue. Here, Israel plays a factor since it is helping Azerbaijan militarily.
This has got to be a first priority to make sure that the United States War Department, which is basically the entire government, to make sure that the United States War Department understands that any aggression, physical military aggression toward Iran, will be responded to under full rights of sovereignty in international law and will exert a cost.
The enhancement of Iran-Russia military ties is part of the Islamic Republic's grandeur scheme called Look to the East. This not only involves Russia, but also China. Iran's induction as a permanent member to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, is just one such example. Three countries which have been targets of U.S. sanctions can now stand as a bulwark against American hegemonic endeavors.
Iran's top military commander has also announced that Tehran and Moscow have come to some good agreements concerning the expansion of the two sides' naval cooperation. On the expansion of maritime ties, the Iranian general pointed to various aspects of the two sides' maritime cooperation, such as the issue of Iran's participation in Russia's maritime drills, each side's participation in their respective armies and military competitions, and the mutual exchange of operational experiences. The two sides also talked about the meeting of the naval commanders of the Caspian littoral states and cooperation for the common Caspian maritime security.
This kind of mutual assistance against external threats provides a basis and a foundation for a broader network of self-defense. And this is the key word here, defense.
Then comes the issue of Iranian arms purchases from Russia. Iran plans to purchase defensive equipment from Russia, which comes after the termination of a decade-long UN arms embargo on Iran. It was on October 18, 2020, that the embargo was lifted under the Security Council Resolution 2231, which endorsed the 2015 nuclear agreement, officially known as Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
As this core alliance between Russia and Iran for self-preservation expands, we will see a large number of countries trying to join this kind of a peace-oriented self-defense mechanism.
The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump suffered an embarrassing loss after it failed to renew the Iranian arms embargo through a resolution of the UN Security Council. Iran's accession to become a full member of the SCO after waiting for years is another expansion of Iran's Look to the East policy. This involves the expansion of political, economic, and security cooperation led by Russia and China. The enhanced military cooperation between Russia and Iran can only bring about stability for the West Asia region.
Iran and Turkey have stressed on the need to confront terrorism in the region. In a phone call between the Iranian foreign minister and his Turkish counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian expressed concern over increasing terror attacks in Afghanistan, urging Muslim countries to play an effective role in this regard. He described next week's ministerial meeting in Tehran as an opportunity to exchange views with Afghanistan's neighbors to facilitate bringing peace and stability to Afghanistan. Mevlut Cavusoglu, for his part, called for practical action to prevent terrorist attacks in Afghanistan and to fight terror groups such as Daesh with the help of neighboring countries. Iran's foreign minister noted on the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of neighboring countries. The U.S. military has to delay its hypersonic weapon system due to a rocket failure. According to Reuters, the U.S. attempted test launch of a hypersonic weapon suffered a setback when a booster rocket carrying the weapon failed to lift off. Meanwhile, in a separate series of tests, the Pentagon said the U.S. Army successfully tested hypersonic weapon component prototypes. It added the tests successfully demonstrated advanced hypersonic technologies. Meanwhile, Western intelligence sources claim China has carried out a second test of what is believed to be a hypersonic orbital missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden expressed concern about Chinese hypersonic missiles. Diplomatic tensions flare between China and Taiwan as a self-ruled island struggles for international recognition as a sovereign state. This time around, a planned visit to two East European countries by Taiwan's foreign minister has angered Beijing. China is now asking Slovakia and the Czech Republic not to allow visits next week by Joseph Wu to take place, warning the move could undermine bilateral ties. In addition to the two European destinations, the Taiwanese official is also planning to attend a Rome virtual summit on China. Beijing regards Taiwan as breakaway province and claims sovereignty over the island. Taipei, however, is pushing for independence. And with that, we bring this bulletin to a close. Everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tourism. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the 13th episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you to Bahman Hospital, one of the leading hospitals in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Stay with us, please. Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has been carrying this title for more than 200 years. Agha Muhammad Khan Qajar, the founder of the Qajar dynasty, made Tehran the capital of Iran in 1786. Tehran is not only the seat of government and administration of the country, but it is also the commercial, business, and manufacturing heart of the Islamic Republic. Over years, it has become an advanced, modern, and beautiful metropolis where, in addition to historical and old places, many modern and contemporary tourist attractions abound. Tourists, both domestic but foreign, visit Tehran in large numbers. One of these attractions is the Nature Bridge. Nature Bridge is a three-story structure that is 300 meters long and is built at the height of 40 meters. This bridge, which is only used by pedestrians, is located in Tehran's Abbasabad district and towers over the Modarres Highway. The Nature Bridge connects two famous parks of the city, that is Taleghani Park and Water and Fire Park. The special lighting and unique features of this bridge attract many visitors and tourists. There are also a number of cafes and restaurants on the bridge that tourists can visit to relax and eat. Nature Bridge is the first pedestrianized or non-vehicle bridge in the country and the largest non-vehicle bridge in West Asia region. Tehran, as the beating heart of the country, has attracted the attention of many foreign tourists. As far as attracting health tourists is concerned, it is ranked number one among Iranian cities. In fact, Tehran is definitely the first choice for health tourists visiting the country. It is worth mentioning that, according to Travel Risk Map 2019, Iran is on par with countries such as the UK, Canada, Sweden, and Denmark in terms of international security. The Travel Risk Map has been prepared by the SOS International Institute for Global Risk, which measures the level of risk in each country and region around the world based on the existing threats to travelers in terms of violence and political insecurity. Threats such as terrorism, war, social unrest, and crime. In defining this travel risk map, factors such as the stability of transportation infrastructure, the level of industrial relations, the effectiveness of security and emergency services, and the country's sensitivity to natural disasters have all been taken into consideration. Therefore, traveling to Iran is safe. The hospitality of the Iranian people, coupled with the natural beauty of the country, often turn it into a memorable experience for tourists who visit Persia. Eco-tourists and health tourists make up a sizable percentage of travelers who visit this country. In the remainder of this program, we will introduce you to one of the most prestigious and prominent hospitals in Tehran, Bahman Hospital, and we will become more familiar with its history, facilities, and equipment, and the wide range of medical services that it offers to foreign patients. Bahman Hospital is located in West Tehran in Iran Zamin Street. The construction of this hospital was completed in 2006 and it became operational a year later. Bahman Hospital is one of the most beautiful hospitals in Tehran in terms of interior architecture and building construction, which has been built on an 18,000 square meter plot of land. This 200-bed hospital has four floors consisting of different medical wards and an administrative ground floor and two basement floors. Bahman Hospital is a private and general hospital, and in this short period of 14 years, it has successfully established itself as one of the most modern, trusted, and state-of-the-art treatment centers in this northwestern region of Tehran. Certainly, the hospital has been able to receive a certificate of accreditation from Iran's Ministry of Health. Bahman Hospital is also very active in the field of women and children's health and has received the title of the top hospital in promoting natural childbirth and is also known as a child-friendly hospital. The medical facilities of Bahman Hospital include a clinic, paraclinic, inpatient ward, intensive care unit, ultra-modern specialty surgery room, pharmacy, etc. Each of these departments provide a range of services to patients with the best facilities and equipment. For example, the hospital's cardiac intensive care unit has two CCU wards and two post-CCU wards, with a total of 25 active beds, ready to serve patients with heart problems or those who have been transferred to the hospital in emergency. Patients who have had angiography or angioplasty are also referred to this ward. This ward is equipped with a special monitoring system, each of which is connected to a central monitor, and patients admitted to the CCU are constantly observed through a monitor. The surgical ward of the hospital includes a general surgery room and a heart surgery room. The general surgery room of the hospital has 8 active operating rooms with advanced and up-to-date equipment, and the largest and most complex surgeries in the field of general surgery, gynecology, orthopedics, ear, nose, and throat, neurology, laparoscopy, and plastic surgery are all performed there. Bahman Hospital cardiac operating room in an area of about 400 square meters has 4 active operating rooms, and the best equipment has provided the possibility of performing various types of cardiovascular surgery by top surgeons and specialists in the field. Bahman Hospital also operates internationally and has received its IPD or International Patient Department license from the Ministry of Iran's Health Ministry and provides the best medical services to these patients. Patients from many Asian and European countries come to this hospital for treatment. The International Patient Reception Ward is located on the ground floor of the hospital, and patients can go to this ward after entering the hospital and take the necessary measures to admit their patients. Dear listeners, that was the 13th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In case you've just joined us on this series of the show, we've been talking about the women in the life of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being accompanied by my darling sister, Sister Razia Shamini. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam, my sister, Sister Zainab.
Thank you for being with us.
So happy to be here to have a lovely conversation with you.
Inshallah ta'ala, likewise.
Okay, so previously we've been talking about the conduct of the Noble Prophet regarding women. We mentioned two instances of his appreciating what women, such as his mother, his wet nurse, other women like Fatima bint Asad, have done for him, and him putting them in words. Because, you know, there's this beautiful hadith where he says, the Noble Prophet says that when you say to your wife, I love you, it doesn't go out of their mind.
Yeah.
So whatever you say, you know, sometimes women have to hear.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Appreciating them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not just, I have it in my heart. I'm doing whatever. I'm putting everything for her.
Mm.
She wants to hear you say, yeah. I love you.
And it's natural. I mean, we're material creatures.
So do men like
exactly.
their wives to say, I approve of you.
Yes.
I'm so proud of you, right? So putting them in words, that was something that the Prophet was very good at.
And that shows the comprehensiveness of His Eminence's personality, psychologically, spiritually, socially, physically, material. He was so all-inclusive, you know? He knew how to deal with people on a psychological level to keep them happy, to keep them pleased, to draw their hearts to Himself and to His message. We can't be like him because we're not infallible, obviously. But we can study, right? We can educate ourselves. If he's really uswatun hasana, don't you think that we should strive in every field to get closer to that role model?
Definitely. One more thing about the Noble Prophet's life and his treatment of women was that usually when it comes to matrimonial rights and the right of the spouses, some men, not all of them, some men like to keep their wives in the dark regarding what rights they have.
What are they afraid of?
Of losing money and losing their power. So one thing about the Holy Prophet was that he put his wives into the light and he made it crystal clear what rights they had.
He enlightened them.
Exactly. For example, when he married Salama, for those men who are practicing polygamy, they stay with that wife for 7 days after marriage, and for unvirgin women, they stay for 3 nights, right? We have the concept of qasm, or dividing nights between wives in polygamy. For example, in the case of Salama, who had married before the Noble Prophet, she wasn't young, but still, the Noble Prophet came to her after their first night of marriage, and he said, I will stay with you for 3 consecutive nights. That is your right. Of course, this does not mean that after that, I am disregarding you and your status. I do honor you. This is simply because the wives, after their wedding night, they have the right to have their husbands, unvirgin wives, they have the right to have them for 3 nights. But if you wish so, I will stay with you for 7 nights. But if I will have the same behavior with my other wives.
Equality.
Right. So you have the choice. So Umm Salama says that she agrees with the three knights, and that's how...
And that, you know, she'd get to see him more often.
This is one instance of him shedding light on mm-hmm. the right, enlightening them. Two, respecting them.
Right.
Three, explaining to them. There are the misunderstandings.
It's because lack of communication.
Exactly.
Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady here in the studio. I'm with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're talking about the position of women in the life of Rasulullah. Why do men think that they are above communicating with their wives? And why is it that when they are explaining to something, they're mansplaining to her, as if talking down to her? You don't understand this, okay? It's like man stuff. Let me just water it down for you. This is what you get. All right, bye. But Rasulullah could have just said, this is the rule of God. Like it or leave it.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I'm going to just do it. If you don't like it, there's the door. He was like, no, what do you like? How long would you like me to stay with you? And he was so gentle and caring.
Also, an instance of him consulting.
Exactly.
He asked her opinion. Right? Democratically.
He's a prophet of God, for crying out loud. He has absolute
right
and authority
and power.
Exactly.
To do what he thinks is right.
Yeah.
This is the story of him consulting with women. Next, we will move on to another topic. One thing in the seerah of the noble prophet was that there were so many misconceptions or so many customs that was not really correct or mm-hmm. right according to the rulings of Islam and the teachings of Islam. And very mildly and very gently, he tried to replace them. Mm,
in a very subtle way.
Exactly. Mm. One of them is with regards to marrying your adopted son. So this is because they used to think, the Arabs used to think that their stepsons inherit from them.
Mm.
And that they couldn't marry their wives once uh-huh, they divorced
okay,
them.
All right.
So what the noble prophet did was that he had Zainab, one of his cousins, marry his adopted son
Zayd.
And after some time, things didn't work out between them. He married Zainab.
Yeah, Rasulullah is just so open-minded. He wasn't like, oh, how dare you? I chose this wife for you. How right. dare you not make it work out? He's like, oh, okay, didn't work out. All right, guys, I understand.
Yeah, but it's not like, okay, guys, let's speed up the process mm-hmm. and let's just go for divorce. Yeah. Of course, it came as the last option because we know that in Islam, the ugliest, the most detested halal in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is divorce.
For sure.
So, of course, I'm sure that he made sure that there was no other option and everything
exactly.
You know, wasn't working out. So this is one thing that in a very subtle way, he helped change the wrong perceptions or wrong customs. The other one was that it still is a belief that rich people marry rich people.
Mm, cats,
doctors marry right. doctors. Poor marry poor
within
people.
Your own circle.
Yeah, within your own circle. He made sure that this belief was shattered in the minds of people. And one of the reasons that he had Zainab marry his adopted son was that Zainab was a very rich, beautiful
Prestigious
lady.
Aristocrat.
Right, but he was an adopted son, right?
Yeah, right.
So he made it happen. This also shattered the idea of, you know.
But then they ended up divorcing each other. So it was an unsuccessful marriage.
It wasn't necessary.
No.
You know, the essence of Islam for marriage is that, logically speaking, if you marry someone from your own walk of life, then the chances of you being successful
are
higher. This is for cases where
It's totally taboo, right? If you marry someone from a lower caste, I will disown you, hunt you down, and kill you.
Right.
And because that is still existing in a lot of cultures.
Even for the Holy Prophet, many people abandoned Khadija
for Mary.
She married a poor guy who was Muhammad. Mm. And when she wanted to give birth to Lady Fatima, no one came. No woman.
To assist her.
No Quraishi woman came to help her. And she gave birth, you know, by heavenly ladies coming down, right? So even his own marriage was somehow breaking the status quo,
yes,
right,
exactly.
of what was going on. And then, ideologically speaking, if you have the teachings of Islam, wherever you come across differences, you go to the principles. And despite your differences, personal differences, whenever you overcome a problem, you see what Islam says and you can fix your problems, despite your being from different walks of life. This was the idea he was trying to get across, right? Right. But of course, neither was Zainab perfect, nor was Zayd perfect. So the divorce, their marriage didn't work out.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The Noble Prophet used to always say that a believing woman is the match and equal of a believing man.
Mm.
He wanted to spread this kind of teaching.
Right.
And
so the criterion should be your faith.
Exactly.
How firm it is, how devoted you are to it, how much it's your life's priority, how much you can build upon that.
And of course, the way you were brought up and who your parents are, these are also standards that you have to keep in mind when you're getting married. Because remember, they say that do not marry a beautiful woman coming from
a corrupt family.
A corrupted family. So this also you have to keep in mind.
So basically, today's discussion was regarding Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam's treatment of the women in his life. You know, how he held them in such high regards, how he consulted them regarding matters that, you know, concerned them, and how he was so appreciative of everything that any person, especially the women, had done for him throughout his life, specifically because he was orphaned at such a young age, and how he had such a deep psychological understanding of how to deal with the opposite gender. And like you said, since he is Uswatun Hasana, as human beings, whether Muslim ladies or Muslim men, we should strive and we should put effort and endeavor into bringing ourselves closer to that modus operandi of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and creating that psychological deep understanding of human conduct within ourselves so that we can be better Muslims. We wouldn't walk around as Muslims, you know, and who are ignorant and clueless and selfish and don't know how to talk to the opposite gender or how to treat them or how to interact with them and so much more. And this discussion was just so wonderful for me. Thank you so much.
For me too.
Sisida Azia, darling. And thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illa Allah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Failure to pass the decision to cut emissions before the United Nations summit in Glasgow could be catastrophic for purported US efforts to curb global heating. We now present you an article written jointly by Oliver Millman and Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, "This is America's Last Chance, Biden Urged to Act as Climate Agenda Hangs by a Thread." Furious environmental activists at the gates of the White House and congressional U.S. Democrats fretting that an opportunity to tackle catastrophic global heating may be slipping away, Joe Biden is facing mounting pressure over a climate agenda that appears to be hanging by a thread. Biden's allies have warned that time is running short, both politically and scientifically, for the United States to enact sweeping measures to slash planet heating emissions and spur other major countries to do the same. Failure to do so will escalate what scientists have said are irreversible climate impacts, such as disastrous heat waves, floods, wildfires, and a mass upheaval of displaced people. The administration's multi-trillion dollar social spending package, widely claimed the most comprehensive climate legislation ever put forward in the United States, must survive razor-thin Democratic majorities in Congress, and the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has vowed passing time for crucial UN climate talks in Scotland that begin in about 2 weeks' time. Embedded in the measure are plans to dramatically cut carbon emissions, warming the planet and fueling climate disasters, a potentially set of policies that Nancy Pelosi has claimed would serve as a model for the world. But the 31st of October deadline for passing the spending package and a smaller companion infrastructure bill appears increasingly ambitious as negotiations drag on between the White House, Democratic leaders, and a pair of centrist holdouts in the Senate. The prospect of the world's so-called leading economic power arriving in Glasgow with no domestic policy to cut emissions will make it much harder to convince other major emitters to do more at a time when governments are collectively failing to avert unlivable global heating. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat, told Guardian, "They will look ridiculous if they show up with nothing," adding, "It will be bad for US leadership, bad for the talks, and disastrous for the climate. Just disastrous." Senator Sheldon Whitehouse continued by saying, "The vast majority of Senate Democrats understand that this is our last chance to act." The bill includes a program of payments and penalties to ensure utilities phase out fossil fuels from America's electricity supply, a huge expansion in tax credits for clean energy, and new restrictions on methane, a potent greenhouse gas that is emitted from oil and gas drilling. The legislation would slash U.S. emissions by about 1 billion tons by 2030, bringing Biden within striking distance of his claimed target of cutting America's emissions in half by this point. Sheldon Whitehouse also revealed that the president's administration will not oppose a new price on carbon emissions being added to the bill. Following negotiations with Senate Democrats, he said, "We have a very good chance of getting that." The White House did not respond to a request for comment on the talks. The carbon fee, which would initially be set at $15 per ton of emissions before rising rapidly upwards over the course of several years, has long been a favorite policy of economists and some moderate Republicans as a way to encourage polluters to switch to cleaner energy, but has latterly been disregarded by activists and progressives. However, these measures will have to garner the vote of every Democrat in the Senate to pass, with Senator Joe Manchin, a centrist from West Virginia, skeptical of the size and scope of the $3.5 trillion spending proposal. Senator Manchin, a major recipient of donations from the coal industry, has said, "It makes no sense to pay utilities to phase in solar and wind power." Senator Manchin is reportedly set to block the Clean Electricity Program, which forms the main muscle of the climate package. This could prove a hugely consequential blow to the effort to constrain global heating. The climate campaigner Bill McKibben tweeted, "This is high on the list of most consequential actions ever taken by an individual senator," adding, "You'll be able to see the impact of this vain man in the geologic record." Senator Whitehouse admitted it was unclear what Senator Manchin will ultimately do, but that he was confident that there's a window in which negotiations with Joe Manchin can produce a bill to reduce emissions enough so we're not in danger's way. Democrats are working feverishly to trim the $3.5 trillion proposal to about $2 trillion in order to win the votes of centrists without losing the support of progressives. Among the many pressing questions Democrats must answer as they hurtle to meet their end-of-month deadline is how bold to go on climate. Senator Ed Markey, a lead opponent of the Green New Deal, said on a call with reporters recently, "There's a lot of talk recently about what progressive lawmakers need to be willing to cut, what we have to be willing to negotiate on," adding, "Well, we can't negotiate with deadly wildfires. They don't negotiate. We can't negotiate with massive hurricanes. They don't negotiate. We can't negotiate with floodwaters, sea level rise and drought and temperature rise. We can't negotiate how much these climate-fueled disasters are costing us. Tens of billions of dollars so far this year." He said, It's time for us to stop talking about what is politically feasible and start talking about what is scientifically necessary. We cannot compromise on science. The U.S. climate envoy John Kerry said in an interview with the Associated Press, failure to pass the legislation will be disastrous for the United States and the global community. John Kerry warned it will be like President Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement again. Congresswoman Kathy Castor, a Florida Democrat and chair of the House Select Committee on Climate Crisis, said, "The Build Back Better plan will put America on track to meet its goals, but it must not be the only action Congress takes to combat the climate crisis." She added, "More federal action is needed to meet the scale of the emergency." While Biden can do little about the machinations of the Senate, the president has come under growing criticism that his own actions have not matched his rhetoric. President Biden, who has said that the nation and the world are in peril from a code red climate emergency, has reincorporated the United States to the Paris Climate Agreement and sought to supposedly restore some of the environmental rules axed by his predecessor Donald Trump. But his administration has also approved a flurry of new oil and gas drilling permits on public lands, urged oil-producing countries to ramp up production to help lower gasoline prices, and declined to stop major fossil fuel projects such as Line 3, an oil pipeline expansion in Minnesota that has sparked violent clashes between police and those protesting against its construction. Simmering resentment at the president exploded outside the White House recently, with four consecutive days of protests resulting in nearly 300 climate activists being arrested and removed by police. On Thursday, 14th of October, a banner was unfurled reading, "We need real solutions, not false promises," with protesters calling on President Biden to declare a climate emergency and halt a new proposed pipeline and drilling projects. A report released by Oil Change International has found that 21 major fossil fuel projects under review by the administration would cause the emissions equivalent of 316 new coal-fired power plants if they went ahead. Climate scientists have echoed the need for urgency. The world is on course for nearly 3 degrees Celsius of heating by the end of the century, which would bring punishing impacts to people around the globe. Scientists say precipitously steep emissions cuts are needed to occur immediately to avoid this turmoil.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.